David Grevin. I am an associate professor at the University of South Carolina. I am also very proudly a Hunter College alum, as is my very good friend Robert Simonson, who's here tonight as well.
So, go Hawks.
Yes, go Hawks. Apparently the Hawks are a big thing. Are they still very significant? I don't know. I mean, I heard about this after the fact since I never paid attention to the sports world of Hunter while I was there. So this talk is part of this new project of mine that is related to other stuff I've been working on. I have a book called Representations of Femininity in American Genre Cinema that actually tracks the transition of the genre of the woman's film associated with melodramatic narratives and stars like Bette Davis in particular, and how the woman's film genre really transitions into horror, you know, from the 1960s onward. So this talk is part of a new project that I'm tentatively calling Lonely Defiance. The idea that a really kind of isolated, solitary kind of character is really important to American culture. That is always gendered masculine. But I'm arguing in this new project that there's a very strong and powerful tradition of female loneliness in cinema. And I think the woman's film really kind of teems with that kind of figure. Okay, so, but this paper is called Driving Ms. Diva, Hara, the Woman's Film, and the Older Female Star. Playing behind me is the 1964 film Dead Ringer, starring Bette Davis and Bette Davis. She plays twin sisters. in a tour de force. Not the first time she played twin sisters. She also did that in A Stolen Life with Glenn Ford in the late 1940s. If one looks at the careers of the four major female stars of the classic Hollywood era, Bette Davis, Joan Crawford, Katharine Hepburn, and Barbara Stanwyck, it is easy to see that the late 1950s were a particularly fallow period for their movie roles. Davis, Crawford, and especially Stanwyck were transitioning to television series such as Wagon Train, The General Electric Theater, Suspicion, and of course, The Barbara Stanwyck Show. Even Hepburn, who did not transition to television until the 1970s, in her late 1950s roles, they're very few and far between. Death Set, Suddenly Last Summer, Long Day's Journey and Tonight, but not many films of hers are coming out in this period. When the opportunity to star in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, directed by Robert Aldrich, who had previously made films such as Kiss Me Deadly, and the woman's film with Joan Crawford named Autumn Leaves, when this opportunity arose, Davis and Crawford jumped at the chance to play aging sisters who had once been Hollywood starlets and are now trapped in their stifling, dilapidated home and sort of enact sadomasochistic abuse on one another throughout the course of the film. Sparking off the success of Hitchcock's great 1960s Psycho, Baby Jane is a neo-gothic melodrama with shades of horror. It is in keeping with Hollywood's intensive self-scrutiny from the 50s forward in films such as All About Eve, set in the theater world, but same difference, Sunset Boulevard, The Bad and the Beautiful, The Star, also with Davis, The Goddess, Aldrich's The Big Knife, and so on and so forth. The gothic horror melodrama of Baby Jane and its follow-up Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, also directed by Aldrich and with the same person who originated the Baby Jane story involved as well. This is a film that amps up both the horror and the melodrama in Baby Jane. And both films were extremely successful at the international box office, so they're kind of phenomenons in their own way. Baby Jane in particular spawned the rash of horror movies starring older female stars that have been variously called Grandon Guignol, Hag Horror, and Psycho Biddy films. Indeed, the sheer I'm sure there are other names for them too. Indeed, the sheer number of such films is astonishing, as if their having been made and with the stars they featured were inevitable. Davis starred beyond her two films with Aldrich in Dead Ringer, The Nanny, The Anniversary, and Madam Sin with Robert Wagner. Crawford in William Castle's Straight Jacket, Berserk, and the infamous Trog, where she plays, I don't know what she plays, but I think she's an anthropologist and she finds a kind of missing link, a kind of human simian creature, and she shrieks Trog in a very imperious voice when he misbehaves and starts killing people. It's a very regrettable moment in her life. Olivia de Havilland in Hush Hush and Lady in a Cage, Stanwyck in The Nightwalker, Veronica Lake, unfortunately, in the 1970 epic Flesh Feast, Tallulah Bankhead in Die Die My Darling, and many others. Only Hepburn refused to star in any such gothic vehicles, although her Gorgon turn in Joseph L. Mankiewicz's 1959 film version of Tennessee Williams Suddenly Last Summer has to count as some kind of sort of a hag horror type of moment for her. So perhaps inevitably, most of these films, successful to varying degrees in terms of the box office, have been relegated to the ever capacious category of camp. In Susan Sontag's famous 1964 essay, Notes on Camp, she influentially argued that, quote, Jewish moral seriousness and homosexual aestheticism and irony are our defining cultural sensibilities. Sontag's essay remains a touchstone text, although one often critiqued and challenged. For Sontag, camp is always failed seriousness, and she is careful throughout this essay to distance herself from any kind of cultural legitimation or endorsement of camp. While I do not make the case that these Grand Dame Guignol movies, or as I call them, horror women's films, are generally aesthetically sophisticated or politically minded works, I do make precisely that case for certain films in this subgenre, especially Aldrich's Baby Jane and Hush Hush, Straight Jacket, and Dead Ringer, which was directed by Paul Henry, who is Betty Davis's co-star in Now a Voyage of a kind of woman's film par excellence from 1942, where, if you remember, there's always the famous image of Paul Henry lighting both cigarettes in his mouth and then handing one cigarette to Betty Davis. That's that film. So I talk about those films at length in an essay that's published in an online journal called Jump Cut, in an essay called Bringing Out Baby Jane. So just thinking about the woman's film genre, it had its heyday in classical Hollywood from the 30s to the late 1950s, with early films such as Alice Adams with Katharine Hepburn, Imitation of Life with Claudia Colbert and Louise Beavers, Stella Dallas with Barbara Stanwyck, Davis's films such as Jezebel, Dark Victory, Now Voyager, and so on. Crawford's films such as Mildred Pierce, Humoresque, Flamingo Road, and I think her greatest performance in the film Possessed, where she goes mad because the man that she loves, he's an architect, no longer loves her. She loses it in a very hypnotic sort of way. While the women's film genre certainly has, in various forms, endured throughout the decades, transitioning from melodrama to various forms of female-centered drama, Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were, Jill Clayburgh in An Unmarried Woman, Meryl Streep's and Jessica Lange's films, particularly in the 1980s, and to the dreaded rom-com of the present. The horror women's films of the 60s are a particularly interesting moment. They reflect both the reconceptualization of the image of the classical Hollywood star and the rise of modern horror, inaugurated by Psycho, and as Robert Kolker describes in his book, A Cinema of Loneliness, Bonnie and Clyde opened the floodgates. If you remember, Bonnie and Clyde has that climax of this languorous shootout where Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty are kind of beautifully murdered on camera with slow motion and a kind of a barrage of bullets. It's still a very striking moment, very lyrical violence. For several important critics such as Linda Williams and Vivian Sobchak, these horror women's films reflect cultural attitudes of revulsion against the older woman and her aged body and physicality. While I don't fully disagree with Williams and Sobchak, I argue that some of these films, at least, cannot be reduced to these attitudes, and that at their best, they give their heroines surprising license for sexual expression and also for romantic possibilities, even if these are rarely pursued or successfully realized. If the heterosexist demands of conventional Hollywood narrative demand, of course, some version of the female-centered marriage plot, as opposed to the male quest plot, in movies with a woman protagonist, the horror woman's film subjects this normalizing narrative to a certain kind of scrutiny. For example, in Straitjacket, starring Joan Crawford, what is particularly striking is the older woman's sexual vitality and also her demonstration of her desire, which shocks her daughter, played by Diane Baker, and is presented as a contemporary young woman, very much of the modern era, and also an artist who sculpts the female form and also produces masks of her mother's face. Of course, we learn that at the climax when it is revealed that Carol, Joan Crawford's daughter, has been creating these masks and actually performing the axe murders that her mother was put away for, seemingly for life, for at the beginning of the film. So she has framed her mother. But what's interesting is that she wears these masks of her mother, so she kind of inhabits her mother's image, which I find kind of interesting. One of the other really interesting aspects of these films is they have a real obsession with class. And I think the real source of the horror in Straitjacket is Joan Crawford's character, who, yes, is an axe murderess, but that happened like 20 years ago. and you know, she's presented as sort of this kind of coarse, very lower class woman. And then when she is reunited with her daughter has this very proper middle class family. And one of the most wrenching scenes in the cinema is when Crawford has to go to her daughter's fiance's family's house and sit in their kind of parlor. And the class warfare is not only palpable, but direct and explicit, where the fiance's parents say, you know, you're a lousy tramp, what are you doing in our house building it up? It's very, very direct. So I think there's a real powerful class discourse. You see that in Baby Jane also. So what I'm arguing is that there is a queer element in this genre that comes through in their interest in the fate of female sexuality in a culture newly invested in youthfulness and beyond the reproductive and the familial. Dangerous free agents, the older female stars in these films defy the sexual classifications of classical Hollywood that fall so squarely under the categories of virgin and vamp. Desire not tied to marriage and the family has been historically troubling to American culture. And the horror woman's films are volatile in their tentative, but at times palpable exploration of woman's desire when it is not tethered to these institutionalized values. And there is a real dialogue, I think, going on in certain kinds of later films. For instance, Fassbender's 1970s film, Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, which is very much, I think, about sort of a sense of social decay in 1970s Germany, also with fear of this kind of wave of immigrant populations. And so there is, you know, an Arab man that falls in love with an older woman, and she falls in love with him, and they get married. And it's this very interesting sort of, in a way, response to the melodramas. Fassbender was really influenced by Douglas Sirk, who made a lot of famous 50s melodramas starring Jane Wyman and Rock Hudson. So there is a kind of dialogue beyond these films of the 60s. Now, Dead Ringers is an interesting film to think with because it so thoroughly deconstructs Davis' stark image, and like the major horror women's films, the women's film genre, which follows the marriage plot while also making its central drama the fate of the woman's individual idiosyncratic identity, should the marriage plot be successfully achieved. On some level, most of Davis's major films simultaneously foreground and refuse the conventions of the woman's film, inviting the spectator to appreciate the unconventional, against-type, idiosyncratic aspects of Davis's star persona. that Dead Ringers maintains an especially close intertextual relationship to classic Hollywood film is evinced by the origins of the screenplay. According to the invaluable Internet Movie Database, Dead Ringer was based on the story La Otra by American screenwriter Ryan James. The story had previously been made into a Mexican film in 1946, La Otra, starring Dolores del Rio, and was adapted for Dead Ringer, specifically for Davis, after the huge success of Baby James in 1962. This is the story of Dead Ringer. Edie Phillips, Betty Davis, has never forgiven her twin sister Margaret Maggie DeLorca for stealing her boyfriend by claiming to be pregnant with his child. When the well-to-do Francesco Frank DeLorca dies 18 years later of a heart attack, and Edie learns that there never was a baby, something in her snaps. She murders Maggie and assumes her identity, and Edie is pronounced a suicide. However, things become complicated by Maggie's golf pro boyfriend, Tony Collins, played by Peter Lawford, who is very much a fixture in the Kennedy clan and their social gatherings. I think it was maybe even related to the Kennedys. Who's the first to figure out the switch, and by Los Angeles detective Jim Hobson, who was in love with the dead Edie, supposed to be dead Edie. So one of the most striking aspects of the horror woman's film, as I've been noting, is this discourse of class. Economic deprivation matches, reinforces, and also allegorizes the protagonist's sense of loss and overpowering need for recognition. In the film, it's not so much the terror of, in a film like Straitjacket, it's not so much the terror of Crawford's axe murder and past and possible future, as it is the wrenching discomfort she feels in the face of both her respectable farmer brother and his wife, and their bland, homey interior and manner, and the stifling upper middle class standards of her daughter's fiance and his family. So, one of the most interesting of the woman's films was this spectacular disaster from 1949 called Beyond the Forest with Betty Davis. It's a kind of an homage to Madame Bovary. Betty Davis is an unhappily married woman who longs for the glamour and sophistication of Chicago, and she's stuck in a dreary small town with her husband, played by Joseph Cotten, who's a physician who's very, very generous and spends all of his time tending to the townspeople and not to Betty Davis's character, Rosa Moline. And there's a very interesting way in which something I'm trying to recover in this book is a lot of texts that get kind of discarded or denigrated or simply relegated to the category of camp. They're kind of celebrated as camp, but then they're also ignored and forgotten. And I'm saying that there's actually more going on in these films. They deserve to be re-examined. And something that I find very interesting that goes along with this idea of class consciousness in these films is there, and I'm including Beyond the Forest in this, which I think is a great film, even though it was an infamous disaster. I don't know if you remember, but there's a moment in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf where Martha, played by Elizabeth Taylor in the movie, does an imitation of Betty Davis from Beyond the Forest. What a dump, you know, when she goes inside her house. And actually, in Beyond the Forest, Betty Davis simply says, looking at this drab house she's living with Joseph Cotten, she simply says, what a dump. But I won't even attempt to reproduce, Elizabeth Taylor tried to reproduce Betty Davis, but there's a lot of sashaying. It's also in Albee stage directions, a lot of sort of moving around the finger with the cigarette and then, what a dump. So, Rosa Moline in Beyond the Forest fetishizes objects, the acquisition of which she craves. So she really fetishizes capitalist kitsch. And as Thomas Kulka writes, capitalist kitsch, exemplified by advertising, uses class distinctions and status symbols to create artificial needs and illusions to foster the ideology of the consumer society. So, okay, I want to show you this clip from Dead Ringers. Dead Ringers is the great David Cronenberg film with Jeremy Irons playing twins. Well, I mean, really, what more is there to add? I mean, to what, there's Carl Malden, who of course plays Mitch in Streetcar Named Desire, the man who might potentially rescue Blanche DuBois. It's kind of interesting that he's cast here. And this clip that I want to show you, Bette Davis as Edie, who has lived a kind of much more working class than her sister, who duped this man into marrying her, and then she was able to enjoy all his wealth. What's interesting to me is that the heroine, Edie, is presented as this kind of self-made woman who refuses any of the material possessions that her sister is kind of awash in, right? But as soon as the husband has died, and it's just this space that's being negotiated between the two sisters, suddenly Bette Davis's kind of working class self-made heroine begins to fetishize these capitalist objects. So she becomes seduced by the allure of capital, which is something I think is really interesting. So would you be able to help me to show?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So scene four. So, just to introduce it, so Frank, the woman that Edie loved, but then her sister Maggie stole from her and married, Frank has died, and so Edie has gone to Frank's funeral, and Maggie invites Edie back to their mansion, and then they have this conversation where they confront one another. Okay, there's the fur coat that suddenly catches Edie's eye.
What do you mean? My favorite reading all these years has been the social activities of that distinguished couple, the Frank DeLorens, and seeing them occasionally. Where do you live now? In LA? In Los Angeles? For the past 10 years? Yes, I have a cocktail lounge on Figueroa Street called Edie's. Why didn't you ask me?
For the fair out of town?
The last time I left Los Angeles, you met me at the station with the glad news that you were pregnant and that Frank was marrying you.
Oh, but Edith, that was 20 years ago.
To be exact, 18. You really hate me, don't you? You've never forgiven me in all these years.
Why should I? Tell me why I should.
Well, we're sisters.
So we are. And to hell with
Thank you, Henry.
So, something I think is really interesting in that scene is that one of the characteristics of Davis's star persona, I mean, she was not considered, I mean, much to her chagrin, she was not considered conventionally attractive. But as Martin Shigler has shown, a lot of her films, particularly Mr. Skeffington, play around with the idea of sort of imagining her as this beauty and sort of creating this kind of almost satirical distance between the performer and the role that she's playing. And I think that there's a kind of deliciousness in seeing Bette Davis in her much more usual role as drab and unglamorous. I mean, this is something that Davis strove for in many films, to appear physically ugly, to be as unvarnished as possible. For instance, in Marked Woman from the 30s, where she plays basically a prostitute in a mafia-run nightclub, at one point she's brutalized, and Davis insisted on having very graphic and grisly makeup to show the real violence that was inflicted. You know, she plays Elizabeth the Queen, it's very, you know, physically grotesque. So Davis was comfortable with this. So when she's playing Edie, this is actually kind of a weird abstract expressionist like riff on the film itself. It's kind of interesting. But when Davis is playing Edie, she's inhabiting her much more conventional or much more typical star persona, but she's playing against a version of herself, a kind of idealized mirror version of herself that is supposed to be this glamorous, sophisticated, moneyed woman. And I think that there's a kind of almost an erotic frisson in that scene of sorts. I also think, again, there's something kind of interesting about the way that capitalist kitsch is very seductive. You know, Edie says to Maggie, I wouldn't ask you for the fare out of town, but then when Maggie's not looking, she's actually donning the fur coat, looking at herself in the mirror, imagining what it would be like to inhabit this woman's identity, and even her body. The other really interesting aspect of many of these films is a concept that Helena Michie calls sororophobia, which is a kind of deep antagonism between sisters. And I also find that interesting in terms of thinking about a feminist reading of these films, which I can assure you has not often been attempted. But there's something about the way in which culture pits women against one another and produces this kind of enmity between women that I also think is striking as a preoccupation of these films. And so that shot of Bette Davis, where she's really dwarfed by this patriarchal image of Frank, she's almost consumed by this portrait, I think is really interesting. And his power and identity, and the fact that he betrayed her as well as his sister did, none of that really gets particularly emphasized in the film. He remains a kind of idealized image. I feel like I'm holding like vodka or something, I'm just swinging. But you know, he's this idealized patriarchal image that remains fairly unquestioned. And I think that the battle between the women in some ways reinforces some maybe sexist stereotypes about the way women behave towards one another, or something about an essential female identity. So I would say that that aspect of the film is not particularly feminist. It's not particularly resistant. But at the same time, I think that it's allowing you to see the way Edie gets seduced by capital. There is something interesting going on there, and it again behooves us to think further about this. So I wanted to show you one more clip from the film. And I'm so thankful to you for being so helpful. Thank you. Oh, by the way, the score is by Andre Previn. So you may know him from other contexts, but anyway. So these films are interesting in that they give the older, the aging female star opportunities to experience or enact romantic or sexual scenarios that would have been associated with their earlier films and are now being associated with, of course, the greater freedom and expressiveness of the sexual revolution in the 1960s. You know, in a more respectable kind of version of the woman's film, Where Love Has Gone, where Betty Davis plays Susan Hayward's mother, and I think it was even made before Dead Ringer, Davis has this kind of horrible old lady wig that they put on her. She's really kind of shriveled and not particularly imaginable in a sexual or desiring context. But something about the horror genre gives these women an opportunity to express or manifest or pursue their desires in a way that other kinds of genres are just simply closing off the possibilities of, you know, of their doing so. So here is a scene that I want to show you where Carl Malden, who had been in love with Betty Davis's character, yes, I'll explain it. So Peter Lawford plays Maggie's lover.
Oh, well, somebody clue me in. What stone is this?
Headstone in my sister's grave.
When did she die?
The day of the funeral. That is Mr. Dolores' funeral.
That must have been rough on that. What did she die of?
She committed suicide.
Getting along, I just wanted to say thank you and that I'm sorry I spoke out of turn the other day.
Quite all right, Sergeant.
Mrs. Lorca, something's been on my mind. The night you were down there with Edie, did she say anything about me?
What night was that?
The night she committed suicide. She said nothing about marrying me?
No, Sergeant.
Well, maybe if I just laid it on the line. Look, guy, I'm sorry if I disturbed you. Sorry.
Would you have some lemonade, sir?
What was your sister's name?
Edith.
Is that the twin sister who lived in San Francisco?
Yes, she moved to Los Angeles a few years ago. Oh, Tony, I'd like to forget all about it.
I'll make you forget. You don't want me to make love to you? I don't understand after all the fun we had. Honolulu, Nassau, Miami. It was fun, wasn't it?
Well, of course.
You're not Marv, it's your Edith.
Maggie and I know, but you're not.
Mama, you killed her. The smoking, the dog.
Do you want to file a complaint, Mrs. Lorca?
Oh, no, Sergeant, please.
Whatever you say.
We got a few things to talk over, Mrs. DeLocca. I'm gonna take you for everything you've got. For openness, the Maserati convertible, 14 grand, plus tax and license.
The estate will be in probate for a year. I only have my living expenses.
Oh, you overlooked the DeLocca rock pile. The diamonds, the emeralds, And those pearls look so beautiful when Maggie wore them. Let's start with that ring. The bracelet. Call it pay as you go. Come on, baby. It's safe cracking time.
Something that I think is another unexplored thematic in the woman's film is a theme of domestic violence or just physical violence against women. And I don't really think there's been an enormous amount of work done on it, but there is a very interesting film from the 40s called Deception that reunites the cast and the director of Now Voyager. It's a film that stars Bette Davis, Paul Henreid, and Claude Rains, and is directed by Irving Rapper. And there's basically a plot that is very post-war. Paul Henreid has come back from the war to find Bette Davis living on her own in her apartment and having a friendship with a man who's clearly a screaming queen, played by Claude Rains. But Paul Henreid is obsessed with Claude Rains' character named Hellenius and is convinced that Bette Davis is having an affair with him. But there is a lot of coded and not so coded suggestions that actually Paul Henreid is brutalizing her in this film. And again, I don't think that that really gets discussed very often, but something that I found very interesting about this scene was how striking the eruption of violence is. And the way that Bette Davis plays Edie in this scene is so incredibly realistic, I think. I mean, she's almost cowering, almost, you know, really fearful for her life, in proximity to Peter Lawford. I also think that there's a very interesting touch there at the end. I mean, that is actually a great line. It's safe cracking time, baby, or something like that. Sort of something out of a crime movie or something. But that he's sort of breaking up Bette Davis into these components. He's sort of breaking off pieces of her and claiming them for himself. And there's a way in which her seduction by Capital results in her really being a commodified object, where she's actually almost literally breaking off pieces of her flesh to get to this man. But did anybody notice anything in either of those scenes that struck you, sir? Oh, you look like you were on the verge of an epiphany.
I've actually seen this film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And did you like it?
I did. I caught it late at night. It was showing on television. You know, it was quite unexpected. And I did not expect to watch it because it was late Bette Davis, and I expected it would be atrocious. But it actually did kind of draw you in, the double portrayal. And the final cast.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's actually very well made. Paul Henreid didn't make a lot of films, and most of the few films that he made are not available on DVD, but he did an enormous amount of television work. And I mean, there's really an explosion of sort of television starring classic Hollywood stars. Or people working behind the industry. I mean, just as a sidebar, Ida Lupino, who was a very famous actress in the 40s, actually becomes a really significant director. And she makes films like The Hitchhiker and The Bigamist, but then she transitions into the television medium. Anyone else? Anyone notice anything? I think there's also something kind of interesting about the way in which, here I am, I'm talking about these films give the older woman the ability to desire and to pursue her sexuality or experiment with it even. But then, the film, Dead Ringer that is, does decouple capitalist desire from sexual desire, because Edie is obviously erotically charged by the act of putting on that fur and looking at herself in the mirror in this kind of narcissistic moment, right? And, you know, it brings up Joan Riviere's work, the psychoanalyst Joan Riviere, where she talks about femininity as a masquerade that women have to perform, often a very uncomfortable performance of femininity itself. But then, when she's in that scene with the golf pro, played by Peter Lawford, and he's of course testing her out, but he's sort of attempting to be seductive with her. The way that Bette Davis plays that scene is very interesting. She seems really distanced from any thought of sort of a sexual encounter with him. And I think also casting Carl Malden, who's another unconventional looking actor of the period, is another subtle suggestion on the part of the film that actually Edie has a kind of detached relationship to her own sexuality or to her own heterosexuality. So I think that, you know, these kinds of moments are sort of there in these films, and I'm kind of curious about why they have not been examined as such. There is, as I started off by saying, there is a strong feminist critique of these films that frames them as really politically troubling because they foreground this horror at the, you know, the older woman's body. But I actually think that they're, and then you know, the queer response to the films has been, these are camp classics and are sort of to be enjoyed as these kinds of you know, hysterical pageants of ridiculousness. I remember when I used to serve cappuccino and espresso at the Film Forum, which was one of the best jobs I ever had in New York City. In fact, it was probably the best job I ever had in New York City. And I remember, you know, sneaking into the theater when they showed Straitjacket, and there's a scene in Straitjacket where Joan Crawford, who, when she's released from the insane asylum for having been an axe murderess, released 20 years later, she looks like an old woman, her hair is gray, she's in these really prim, dowdy clothes, and she's very held in. Crawford gives a really great performance in Straitjacket, actually. But then, she dresses up as her original self, Lucy Harbin, who was, I think there's a line, something like, she was a 10 o'clock girl in a 9 o'clock town. You know, she's sort of dressed in these, like, she's got this dark wig and she's got huge bracelets and she's got kind of a bustier, and she's very kind of vital and sort of coarse, but also in a very kind of sexually charged way. And so she puts on this old getup that she used to wear, and she kind of flirtatiously has a drink with her daughter's fiance. And the audience reaction to this is almost, I mean, the laughter and the revelry in the scene is almost overpowering if you watch it with an audience, you know? And I definitely think that, it's, you know, when Bette Davis says to, you know, Bette Davis, and to hell with you, you know, I mean, you can't watch this without having that kind of camp response. It's impossible not to do so. But I think what I'm trying to suggest is there is also a kind of, at least, negotiation of the kinds of roles that were given to women in this period. There is a kind of awareness that there's a sort of deprivation associated with these roles. And so the horror women's films actually give these women an opportunity to shine in a way that other genres simply were not interested in doing. So anyway, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'd be happy to, if anyone has any questions or...
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Because in the summation that we sent out, that we talked about, you were going to also touch on, I mean, it's called Dragon Miss Diva.
Right.
Like, touch on sort of the older woman as she's portrayed now in, like, on TV or in, I don't know, even Downton Abbey or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I think what's very interesting is that the old woman doesn't disappear from films after the 60s, but she becomes repurposed as a kind of culturally legitimated icon of either female wisdom or kind of enduring strength, right? Or that she is presented as a kind of a relic of another time who can undergo a transformation and become more modernized. So, you know, Jessica Tandy's role in Driving Miss Daisy, for which Tandy won an Oscar, of course, is a very interesting comparison because there is absolutely no suggestion whatsoever that Jessica Tandy's Daisy ever had an erotic life of any kind. There's no possibility for this. If you look at someone like Maggie Smith on Downton, who's probably the most popular character on the show, again, there's something actually of the horror movie of the 60s about her character, in the sense that she is this kind of Gorgon figure. She's a kind of an almost frighteningly powerful character, right? And she certainly is that in the first two seasons. But you can see, especially in the current season, that she's very softened, she's very idealized, even sentimentalized. She's shown to be a much more conventionally sort of loving grandmother, right? So that kind of phallic authority that she started off with has generally kind of just subsided, and it's almost ebbed away. So I think I don't really see a lot of examples from contemporary films of older woman characters who exceed the paradigm of what an older woman character is. She's either going to be a maternal or a grandmotherly figure. She's going to be a kind of, you know, sometimes what will happen is the older woman will be a kind of bawdy figure where she'll say something sexually provocative and shock everybody, right? But the older woman rarely gets an opportunity to actually be the protagonist of a narrative. She's rarely given anything like the kind of screen space and sort of possibilities that the horror woman's film was giving these actresses in the 60s. I don't know why that is.
What kind of roles do you think Betty Davis would have if she was living today and was the same age?
It's so hard to imagine her particular kind of theatrical performance, sort of in anything but a kind of caricature or supporting role. I don't think that she would have. My sense is she wouldn't have the opportunity to dominate, say, a feature film. She would definitely be relegated to that, you know, character actress, supporting player.
She wouldn't have a career like Diane Keaton and Meryl Streep has these days, where they continue to be a leading actress, you know, even as they're approaching 60 or passing it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there is something extremely fascinating about Meryl Streep's continuing appeal as a leading actress.
Mm-hmm.
Meryl Streep, especially if you look at her films of the 80s, is definitely in the Betty Davis tradition. The range of roles, especially the emphasis on melodrama. I think that, for one thing, we have seen a really profound normalization in terms of body types, body images, the kinds of people who get represented on screen. I mean, Betty Davis's entire sort of physical persona, I don't think would be in keeping with contemporary emphases on this kind of almost superhuman body that people like Meryl Streep and Diane Keaton have. I mean, they are just much more conventionally attractive. Again, I'm really emphasizing conventionally. There's something not as threatening about their physicality. I just don't see, if you look at Betty Davis in Dead Ringer, I think that she seems just encased in that period. She doesn't seem imaginable in 2014 to me in that kind of role. Does she to you? Does she?
Well, I always found her otherworldly, no matter what decade she was in.
Now, when you say otherworldly, what does that mean exactly?
Meaning I don't know anyone like Betty Davis, and I don't think anyone else did.
Yeah.
As far as the character she played. Actually, in this film, I found at least when she plays Edie, she's much more naturalistic than she usually is.
Right.
At least to me.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very interesting point, because Joan Crawford in Straitjacket, when she plays the Lucy Harbin, who's just been released from the insane asylum, her acting is quite naturalistic. It's not stylized, it's not melodramatic, it's not sort of theatrical in the way that you might expect. And in a way, there's almost a kind of, surprisingly, a kind of Italian neorealist influence, I think, in these 60s films, that they are actually trying to maybe capture something more lifelike and everyday,
mm-hmm.
in a way that they might not have done earlier.
Now all these female horror films, as you call them, are more directed by men, right?
Pretty much entirely, yeah.
I think that makes a big difference. As to, like, say, if we could, they were hypothetically directed by women,
mm.
and how the characters were portrayed on screen.
Mm. 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 Well, you know, if you look at the films by one of the few really prominent female directors of the period, Ida Lupino, who had been an actress, they really emphasize female sexual trauma and violation. And I think it's certainly imaginable to me that if a woman director was making these films, they might actually contain more of the emphases I'm occasionally discovering, as in that scene that I showed you from Jed Ringer. I mean, given that it's a male director, I think it's kind of interesting that we are put in the position of inhabiting Betty Davis's terrorization by this man. I think there is something of a feminist consciousness here, that we are made to feel her endangerment here. You look like you're not fully. Yeah. So, you know, there's something I think always interesting about the woman's film, in that it actually has the audience, whether they are female or male or not, either of those things, to identify with the woman protagonist. That's what always makes it not, I mean, it wouldn't be fair to call the woman's film a feminist genre, but there is always this potential for identifying with female experience that I think makes the films always on some level kind of resistant.
Kind of what?
Resistant or, sort of politically aware of their own time period, their own genre, their own kinds of representational practices. They're always aware of the woman's social position. They're always aware of the, what I'm trying to say is the female subject position in society, right? Where, marriage is always an extremely important part of what's going on in the woman's film. It's always, will the woman find the man who will appreciate her for her idiosyncratic vitality and make her a married woman? That's always the drama. And I think that's another thing that makes these women's films, these horror women's films, so interesting, is that it's imagining a female sexuality that is not necessarily tied to marriage or reproduction, which is always really problematic for culture. If you can't contain the woman's sexuality in those roles, then what is it for? What is it doing? What is it about? That's also, I would say, the queerness of these films. I mean, obviously those questions are raised in terms of queer sexuality as well, and continue to be raised by some people at times. Anything else?
What happens? Does she get away with it?
No, she gets the electric chair. She gets the electric chair. And at one point, she says to Carl Malden, she says, I think his name is Joe, she says, "Don't you know me, Joe? I'm Edie." And Carl Malden says, "Edie would never have done such a thing. You can't be So there's something about Bette Davis's inability to actually even reveal the truth to this man that she loves. She can't even tell him who she actually is. So she goes to the electric chair as Mary. Because actually, Maggie, whom Bette Davis killed earlier, and Peter Lawford plotted to kill Maggie's rich husband in the pocket of the money. So Edie is not punished for her crime of killing Maggie, but she is punished for Maggie's crime of killing. Oh, what a tangled web we made. First we practiced to kill our sister and then